Hello and welcome to this special edition of Spectator Radio. I'm Katie Balls. What is the role of intelligence in defence? Knowing your enemy has always been vital in traditional warfare. But with the dawn of digital technology and social media, defence seems to have taken on a different character. One where information is not just vital to war and peace, but its defining characteristic. Our relations with Russia is a case in point. Though we are not at war, the British government is constantly battling information attacks from Moscow, whether in the form of disinformation campaigns or cyber attacks. To win in this new age of defence, Britain must establish its information advantage. So, how well equipped are we? To break down the notion of information advantage and what British defence needs to do in the 21st century, I'm joined by Professor Peter Roberts, Director of Military Sciences at RUSI, Dominic Nichols, the Telegraph's Defence and Security Correspondent, and Simon Fovarg, the UK and Europe Chief Executive of Leidos, a technology, engineering and science solutions and services provider which is sponsoring this podcast. So to begin, Dominic, could you help us out by explaining to those who are perhaps not yet in the know, but will be very much so by the end of this podcast, what exactly is information advantage?
Thanks, Katie. It's helpful because no one's actually defined what information advantage is, that I can have a stab at it and people will take issue. And that's great because it then molds what we understand it to be. But to my mind, at its most basic, war, confrontation is a clash between two people over an issue where I decide that going to war will sort it out to my advantage better than using other mechanisms. And you think the same thing. And we decide to have a war and then one of us is proved right. That's the kind of old model. So in that model, that there's a winner and a loser. I happen to disagree with the concept of winners and losers these days, but let's just park that for a moment. But in this concept of a winner and a loser, there's clearly been an information asymmetry. Somebody was wrong. It was clearly not in my interest to go to war if I lost, or your interest to go to war with me if you lost. So that information void in the middle is what we seek to maximise to our advantage through information advantage. So if I'm going to commit my forces to war, and by forces I mean military, diplomatic, intelligence, etc., etc., I want to be as certain as I can be that all those imponderables and unknowns and the whole context of what we're debating, I know more about it than you do, so that if I choose to act, it's going to work out better for me than for you. So that information advantage, I would see as just having a better awareness of the situation, a better awareness of your capabilities, and increasingly, and very importantly these days, a much better awareness of how my actions will be received in the global audience now, because it's that global audience that ultimately gives me the permission to do what I want to do. There's some glaring examples against that. Assad, Syria, Srebrenica, Rwanda, where the world would say otherwise. But generally, most actors, if the weight of global opinion is against a course of action, would cease to do that. So you've got to take that global population into account as well. But ultimately, I view information advantage as being having many, many more tools at my disposal because I understand what's going on and I then decide it's still in my interest to act militarily, diplomatically, with the intelligence services and so on.
I still don't get it. I genuinely still don't get it. We've held numerous seminars on this thing, and the point where it falls over is in two spaces. Firstly, in your war between two people, the examples you used, if I punch you in the face, it doesn't matter whether you can see it coming or not. It doesn't matter if you know I'm going to punch you in the face. If you can't move fast enough and I've got big enough fists, I'm going to hurt you. Who's right or wrong at the end of it is almost immaterial. And
no,
that leads
not,
me to the second point. The second point being is you're articulating war as if it's a war about who is right or wrong. And I don't think that's the case. I don't think anyone has ever thought that's the case, that war is about which idea is right and which idea is wrong. That is so rarely the case, and certainly not the definition of who wins. And I think that sits at the core of this problem with information advantage. You can't explain it because no one really understands what it means. It's a useful catch-all for a variety of stuff that people want funded. But the reality is it doesn't make any difference to the nature or the character of conflict at all.
I'm not suggesting that it's new. I'm just suggesting that it's a way of looking at how conflict, confrontation may come about. It's almost too easy to take the jingoistic line and say that they've sunk one of my battleships, I'm going to go and sink two of theirs. If you don't understand the wider context that you're sat in, then conflict's more likely to happen. And by the way, if you punch me in the face, what would happen is you'd break your fingers. But that's by the by.
That's not true. And I might invite it.
That's the point. I might be so bombastic to invite such a response from you because I'm confident that my defences are such.
Now, Simon, at this point, I'm going to bring you in. Clearly, it can seem as quite a complicated concept, but this relates, I suppose, to the nature of modern defence. And on the surface, it feels like IA, so information advantage, would break down into lots of different aspects. So some of the ones that are discussed are, you know, cybersecurity, disinformation, narrative control, intelligent gathering, and also using AI. How do you see it?
I think I agree with Peter in some respects in that this is not a new concept, but what is new is the velocity and volume of information that people need to deal with, derived from many, many sources, many sensors, and the trick really is still being able to capture, combine those diverse sources in order to establish, you know, new opportunities as well as identify threats that need to be mitigated. And all the while, the cost of acquiring this information is reducing, the volume is increasing. And the way people get benefit out of this is being able to make, you know, better, more informed decisions quicker and ahead of their adversaries and competitors.
Now, I think some of our listeners perhaps are wondering, well, if people need information to their advantage in terms of military defence, what is the urgency? Because the UK is not currently at war. One of the concepts that comes up quite a lot is the grey zone. Now, Peter, I'm going to go to you for a definition this time, seeing as I don't think you necessarily want the first one. Could you explain to our listeners, you know, what do people mean by the grey zone and why is it that actually you need to have keep track on all these things, even though there isn't, I suppose, conflict in the traditional sense right now for the UK and, for example, say, Russia?
So it's a really good question. You know, what is the grey zone? Because this is a relatively new phrase, and it comes out of this romantic notion of the last 30 years of a definition between peace and war, that there are two polar opposites. One is war, where shots are fired, and the other is peace, where we all get along beautifully and obey this mythical rules-based order. And this is an aberration, the last 30 years, of the reality, and it has been the reality of our adversaries, competitors, however you want to call them, who do not believe that there is such a thing as this divide between two polar opposites of peace and war. So we might regard war as something where you perhaps attach limpet mines to ships and blow them up, or you capture large pieces of another sovereign state, or perhaps that you use chemical weapons several hundred times every period of a couple of years. That for us might be war. The reality is that that's happening. So are we at war? Well, no one wants to declare it. And therefore, there's been a beautiful idea that we should call it something of an unwar, a non-peace, a grey zone, something that exists that suits our own frame of reference these days, that doesn't articulate something that is total war, but something that sits between those two. It makes us distinctly uncomfortable, which is strangely peculiar, since the British in particular, but most Western states, have a brilliant history of operating in this space for the last 300 years. In fact, this is where the British excel at competition, operating between peace and war, bending and breaking those rules, using them to gain their own position of advantage. That in itself is the grey zone, and it's somehow pretty lazy of us to have got to a state where we need to use this crutch of a grey zone in order to support current what we call strategy.
Dominic, on that, are we now, I suppose, if you... whether or not the grey zone is a term we should be using, does it ultimately send this idea, or is this idea correct, that we are now a threat in more ways perhaps than ever before if we think about the various forms the country can be a threat? So the fact that because of cyber warfare, because of the internet, because of the technology, there are more ways to hurt a country.
I mean, that's certainly true, I would suggest. That doesn't necessarily... There are more ways to hurt a country. I wouldn't necessarily say that means there are more threats out there. I don't think enough people really dig into what they understand by threat and risk, and all these different terms are banded around when we've got to take into account the probability of an event happening, and is that more likely or that more likely? So which one is the greater threat, and what can I do about it? If there's a large threat that I can actually do something about, so shipping in the Gulf, if I can deter that threat from Iran by putting more Royal Naval assets in the Gulf, as a very big threat, but fairly easily mitigated, or a smaller threat, cyber crime in the country, or the threat of all the ATM hole-in-the-wall machines not dispensing money for 48 hours, how resilient is society to that? That's a smaller threat, but might be a higher probability, possibility, and a greater risk to our society. So threat in and of itself is, I don't think, the right way of thinking about this. But there are certainly more, oh God, cliche coming up, attack vectors through which you can have a go at the UK, because any country, because it's so connected to the world now. But I just think a lot of these things, I mentioned the Gulf a moment ago, and I think that's an interesting model. And I'd really be interested in your thought, Peter, on this one, and Simon, because in that instance, so what is happening over there? There's a known risk from Iran, which bleeds into military, diplomatic, intelligence, social, everything. And you could argue that there's a real threat and an information disadvantage, because we don't quite know what America's posture is, and nothing happens in the Gulf, no matter who, whatever side you're on. America sort of calls the shots. Saudi Arabia's response to the attacks on the Aramco oil facility was ultimately pegged against what America would be happy to allow to happen. So this retreat from the Gulf under the current US administration leaves this void. We're not entirely sure where we are. We're not entirely sure what the response is going to be. Somebody, Iran, shoots down a $200 million drone. 20 years ago, that would have been an act of war, but it's not now. Why is it not? Because there's no loss of life, possibly. Is that the benchmark now? Loss of American life? Is that the absolute arbiter? So in this void of information, and that might then mean that there are greater threats to us, because we're not entirely sure of where we stand and how people view it, and everything seems a greater threat because of it.
I mean, I think that is interesting, is because the Gulf is really interesting because the recent incidents with Iran have nothing to do with information, but about our understanding. And effectively, Iran has been allowed to get away with coercive actions that have always been allowed in relations between GCC, American-sponsored states, whatever you want to call them down there, and the Iranians. It's been allowed to undertake close passes of US ships. It's destroyed in the public domain a model of a US aircraft carrier. It has made close passes and shot at American ships. They've taken British tankers. You know, this is not something new. So the idea that somehow this is an aberration, I'm not sure is correct. What has happened more recently is there has been a failure to understand the Iranian perspective and the Iranian understanding of these rules. That the rules of competition which the Iranians are undertaking are fundamentally different from our own. This has nothing to do with information. This is about actually our investment in understanding of them. That in itself is not based on information, more data or anything else. And in some ways, therefore, this is not really about information action, information advantage, information decisiveness, superiority, whatever you want to call it. It's something completely different from that. Now, that's not saying that we can't use information and data to understand Iran, but it's actually what we use the data for that is distinctly different. And that's why it's helpful to think about information advantage in terms of the Gulf.
Do you agree with that, Simon?
Undoubtedly, it's a world full of uncertainty and change, where it's not as clear as it has been in the past, and the pace of change will not slow. And therefore, part of it is technology and being able to scan, collect information. Part of it is around the analysis, the visualization of the data, for which there are tools, techniques and technology that can help. I think the pit that you may be pointing at there is around taking that understanding and gaining some insight out of it, where the notion of diversity can bring quite a bit to play. I mean, there is an argument that has been played out around 9/11, in that why did we not spot the rise of Osama bin Laden and the extremism supported on him by the intelligence agencies? Because they all approached it in a similar way. They recruited people from the same backgrounds, thought in a similar way. And I think part of achieving this advantage, if you like, doing something better, more quickly than your competitor, military or otherwise, is trying to make good decisions based on that diversity of information and also thought that people can bring to bear.
Now, I want to move on to the next part and talk about, Britain's status and all this. But just before we do, Simon, one thing I wanted to touch on was, ultimately, there's lots of different forms to this, but it does seem because of technology, new systems, it is in theory easier to share data and information than ever before, if you think, between countries or even between different, I suppose, organisations within a country. Is that something that can help with information advantage?
It's a factor that contributes to the volume and velocity of data and information out there. In terms of that shared understanding, again, technology can help, but there is also very much a human factor to it. So I wouldn't want to look at it from just through a technology lens, but there is also a people in terms of that diverse demographics, as it were, diverse thinking, skills and training, as well as processes which we need to continually adapt all three. Adapt and develop technology, our people and skills, and our processes to deal with it. And it's a combination of those things that will ultimately give us some form of ability to perform better than our competitors or adversaries.
Now, moving on to how well Britain fares in this discipline. Dominic, how good are Brits at achieving information advantage? So I suppose getting the upper hand in difficult battlegrounds.
How good?
Perhaps there's a basic way of putting it.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because I agree with Peter that Brits have been very, very good at surviving in confrontation and conflict. It's been said of the British Army that they lose every battle except the last one. This idea that you get bashed around and you just cling on and you transform in contact, happened in 1918, happened recently in Afghanistan, and you somehow get to the finish line and you either prevail or get a score draw, whichever way it is, but you're not defeated. So Britain has always, I suppose as a mongrel nation, always been able to adapt to whatever new circumstances throws at it. So the new age of information, cyber, global connectivity, that's not particularly new to that. It's interesting, Simon's point, that greater access to data leads to better decisions. I'm not entirely sure about that, because we've seen in election campaigns of recent years that actually the greater access, you could argue, allows echo chambers and people decide what information to draw where they draw their information from, and it can just underline those existing prejudices. And so as all technologies, it's a deeply personal and deeply human activity, how we choose to use technology. So is Britain better placed than, what's the benchmark, against whom, against which country? We're not in a bad place. I think as a tolerant, open, liberal democracy, we're able to take on ideas and largely see the benefits of new ideas and thinking and technology. And so I think we're pretty resourceful and able to weather a course through some pretty choppy seas.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that whilst I am very to sit here and slander information advantage because I don't understand it, having looked at it for a couple of years, what I will say is that the British military is one of the few that is testing itself against this idea that it's not been afraid to go and challenge the orthodoxy, to get outside its comfort zone and look at something like information and start to wonder what it can do with it. Now, whether it should have put this into doctrine and be at the forefront of where it is, well, you know, that's a challenge and, you know, rightly one that people could answer. But the reality is there are so few militaries anywhere in the world that are embracing concepts like this in such a forthright and dynamic way. And for that, the British military has to be applauded. I mean, this was led by the British Army. It was spearheaded by a bunch of really bright people who saw something, a glimmer. And the fact that the military was able in the UK to get a handle on this and to forge forward, even if it's ended up in probably the wrong place, you know, is something that should be applauded. I mean, the military has problems, particularly the British in its relationship with this technology, the idea that the pace of change is so huge in technology that it's moving on faster than ever. I mean, in 2006, I had an iPhone in my pocket, right? I mean, probably so did you. So we haven't moved on that far. It's not moved that fast. I can't look at anything and say, my God, that's been utterly transformative in my life. I don't see that. It's moving. It's not necessarily faster than we had in the Industrial Revolution or the Medical Revolution or the Agricultural Revolution. It's certainly progressing. Whether it's making us more productive or less productive is a matter for debate. But what you can't argue with is the British military's ability to embrace and challenge ideas and concepts, to get out there ahead of the crowd and test itself. Now, that, to me, is a sign of the strength of the British military, that intellectually, it is in the middle of a revolution. It is starting to understand and embrace these concepts of change and get inside them. It has a problem with thinking about speed, about, you know, hyperbole over the pace of change and the speed of things happening. I mean, as Nina Collis says, cyber is actually one of the slowest forms of warfare ever been invented by man. And I think there's something in that reality by scholars who really understand this stuff to reflect on the hyperbole versus the reality. But no doubt the British military has areas in this in which it should be admired.
And I wonder to what extent that, you know, this suits the British way, in that some of the platform technology traditionally associated with the military now is becoming so prohibitively expensive and unaffordable and parochial in some areas, that actually it forces us to look at other factors which we're probably quite well suited to, in terms of the human factors, the process factors. They don't cost a huge amount of money, but we could certainly invest time in thinking about it and developing patterns and methodologies and ways of thinking about these problems.
By platform technologies, what do you mean?
Oh, aircraft carriers, ships, vehicles, yeah. Submarines, tanks.
Yeah, so the things we often hear, yes. MPs complaining there aren't enough of it in the chamber.
But and I think you're spot on in the fact that these cheap technologies, which the British military are able to use in a way that might give them an advantage in a conflict, whether it's grey zone or a total war situation or just the normal competition that exists between states, is absolutely right. Provided that we go back to the core strengths of the British military, which reflect British society, that they perform best when they're allowed to act as liars, cheats and thieves. This is when the British have their truest advantage. Now, if they are allowed to use information and disinformation in underhand, sly, cunning and nefarious ways, then they have a chance of delivering an advantage against certain key targets. What they can't do, I think, is express this as a universal panacea to every military problem or every interaction in statehood for which the military is called upon to play a part.
Mm-hmm. Now, touched on there, perhaps the issue of cost, and it is interesting that there are certain senior figures of government who are quite interested in information advantage, perhaps partly for these reasons. But one thing that it seems to provide is this idea of connecting organisations and being able to share information. So, Simon, I was wondering, how can private companies help the government achieve a concept like information advantage?
Probably through bringing a wider perspective to the challenge. In most companies, they're not solely focused in one market. I mean, a few are, but generally they're multi-market facing. And so, for example, you look at some of our business where we can look at air transportation and the sort of analytics and machine learning that helps inform airlines around aircraft schedules and the impact that has on getting people efficiently, smoothly through airports, together with the biometric information that we are supporting the Home Office with at the point of entry, together with, for example, some of the techniques that we operate in the oil and gas industry, subsea, looking at automated vehicles and geospatial intelligence. They all require similar sorts of technologies in terms of analysis, machine learning, automation, data science, where you can draw on experiences from different market sectors to build a richer picture in order to deliver a better outcome, a better experience, or enable you to reinvent a different business process. And I think, you know, that is sort of in many ways similar to US Homeland Security. You've transposed that back into the UK. You can see a role where the Ministry of Justice and some of the services that it delivers to the, you know, to the wider public might be combined with some of the things that the Home Office does and some of the things that the Foreign Office does and some of the things that the MOD do to provide that collective homeland security. But that is informed by a whole range of different activities in markets that industry are involved in that can bring that experience to bear.
And just briefly on that, we touched on innovation, the idea that some of these things are new areas. So does that require, in terms of recruitment, new personnel or, you know, new people with, I suppose, different skills to bring to the table?
There is definitely a way of thinking. I mean, we can spend some time defining what innovation is, but I don't propose to do that right now. There is definitely a human component to it, but in several dimensions. Recruiting people with the right skills in the right technologies to be able to develop some of those capabilities is one. But there is also an attitude and mindset that you need to try and inculcate into people that drives innovation in many respects. And it's about creating a safe environment culture where you can encourage the diverse thinking and ideas that will lead to genuine innovation without stifling it. So I think it's a range of things, not necessarily technology, but more importantly around the human, from a sort of a cultural perspective, a environmental perspective, as well as skills and capability that people bring to that process.
Now, stepping away, I suppose, from just a UK focus here to give it some context on a global level. Peter, when we're considering, and I'm going to use the term again, information advantage, internationally, do you think we're playing catch-up with, you know, Russia and China? I think for a lot of people listening to this podcast, we touch on the Gulf, but if you think about, I suppose, where information can sometimes be used to a country's advantage or perhaps disinformation, Russia's one that does come to mind for a lot of people. You look at Salisbury and the aftermath, what lots of people thought was a disinformation campaign.
Russia, interestingly, uses information as a tool of statecraft, not a tool of the military. It does it for aims, whether they are specified political aims, whether they're outcomes that they want is slightly dubious, but they know roughly the direction that they want to go in. And so they're able to take the gloves off of their hackers, their information teams, and allow them to spread their own version of truth out into the Western internet without any holes, strings, restrictions. Go forth and do evil, as it were. You know, these are the general instructions from the Kremlin. Now, that's not necessarily a different approach than anything that the West has used previously. Indeed, you know, British, French, American governments have used a similar tool with newspapers, with radios, with television for decades, and has a long and rich history of doing so. So I'm not sure that they are so different from us, or that Britain actually wants to catch up in this way. It is certainly ahead of the US military in some of these things, but not in other areas. In many ways, there are other militaries that are doing information as part of the business much better than the British, and there's no doubt the British military is definitely going to have to do far more to operate with business who already in many ways is already using information to drive its business in a far more efficient way. But that's different from using information for warfighting. And I don't think at this stage we really understand how the British want to use information as part of warfighting, although we might understand both how China and Russia plan on using it, which is as a networked part of a whole effort. It's not the panacea. It is just one of several parts of a wider strategy which they'll use in any confrontation.
That's absolutely correct. And I think what the British state has yet to do is to see information as just one of the possible tools in the arsenal. I mean, what is the BBC World Service if not an information tool, spreading soft power globally, giving a glorious vision of Britain around the world? I mean, that's all there to change mindsets, to influence and ultimately try and change behaviour of friends, foes, and everyone in between. But the British military is yet to really get this in the DNA, I think. I think it's still seen as somewhat separate. For example, every now and again, we get the Russian aircraft carrier Admiral Kuznetsov steaming up and down or belching smoke up and down the English Channel on the way to wherever. And each time we send out whichever frigate or patrol, offshore patrol vessel, whatever is on station that day to go and shepherd her through and make sure she doesn't get up to any more mischief than we're happy with. I mean, why do we do that? If we were to send out nothing, what's he going to do? What's the Admiral Kuznetsov going to do? It's not going to come start shelling Margate. I mean, what is it going to do? If we sent out a training vessel or some Royal Marines in a rigid inflatable boat, would that say to the Russians, yeah, look, we don't rate you. We don't rate your old stinking old battleship that's about to break down. You're lucky it's not being towed through the channel by us. Do we do it a disservice? Do we do ourselves a disservice by stepping up and sending out our brightest and best Type 45, Type 23, etc., etc.? Are we sending the wrong signal there, or is it too spiky to send out something to show overt disrespect? I think there's all these different ways that where messages are passed all day, every day, and I don't know if enough thought is really given to how's the message being received? What do you want to send out there? Who's your audience? How is it being received across different audiences? And how is that part of a whole?
And on that, I suppose, bringing this podcast to a close, Simon, what does Leidos see as, I suppose, the next battlefront of information warfare on the horizon?
I think technology will continue to develop and will enable new ways of thinking, visualising these challenges. But I come back to the human component of it, which is oft overlooked. And I still think we've got a long way to go to develop our approaches and mindset and adapt our cultural way of thinking of this uncertain, fluid world and still break away from some of the established norms and bring that diversity of thought to make better, more informed decisions. So I think for me, it's the technology will do what technology does. It will just keep getting better and people iterate all the time and create new things. But the human component is the bit that I don't think we've quite made the shift yet. I see it inside my company and my business. I see it elsewhere. And that's the hardest thing to move, I think.
I think the origins of information advantage and the idea of what its potential might hold, you get to it through understanding a bit of British military heritage and culture. The melding and blending together of two approaches by British military authors. The first, Basil Little Hart, who advocated the indirect approach, the idea that by attacking an enemy from an unexpected direction, you could discombobulate them and therefore win. And the second being JFC Fuller's Plan 1919, which was about decapitation. If you cut the head off the snake, the rest of the snake will go dead. And in marrying these two ideas together, you come to what I think was the hope of what information advantage would deliver. that being that decapitation is the way to end all wars very quickly. And instead of using precision-guided munitions to kill the leader or the commander of the opposing force, that in some way you can use an indirect approach, that you can use information or cyber to flash a message on his screen that will suddenly make him change his mind and act completely differently. And I think that in many ways represents what senior commanders and politicians hope information advantage would give them. The issue is that neither of these holds true with the nature of character or conflict today. Decapitation strategies have not worked in any campaign that they've been used in since 2001. And the idea that you can use an indirect approach and succeed strategically, again, is at best a hopeful, optimistic view of outcomes, and in reality is a bit like sprinkling fairy dust over a really difficult problem.
Yeah, I agree with Peter. I think this idea that war is a state when peace does not exist any longer is outdated, and it's not right to think, right, war's tomorrow, lads, open the information advantage box. I mean, it's happening right now. Information advantage is just influencing people, influencing mindsets, trying to get other people, other nations to do something that's more favourable to your interest than they are doing today. So it's happening right now. It's happening all the time. And unless that is deeply understood and held at a human level, as Simon suggests, then we're just not going to. We're always going to be behind the power curve on this. Just think it's a thing in and of itself. When it's running all through us, tech enables it, but it's not tech in and of itself.
Thank you, Dominic, Simon, and Peter.